This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about the theme of transitioning as a factor in mental health. And this is a theme we've touched on with previous guests as part of their perspective as transgender individuals, but we've never done a whole episode devoted to what is such a phenomenal life change to go through and something that is still heavily kind of stigmatized and misunderstood, much in the way that other intersecting themes we talk about on the show. Also, whilst we don't get into statistics in the way we used to here on the pod, I'm sure you're aware already how transgender people in particular are so commonly experiencing a level of abuse from others, a level of suicidality in themselves, alongside the experience of working through and figuring out their gender identity. And so if you're not aware of the kind of statistics surrounding that, particularly the ones on suicide, never fail to shock me, even how used to them I am. You know, every time a new statistic comes out, I do have that feeling of like, oh yeah, it is that bad. These stats are that stark. And so if you're not familiar with the statistics, I really encourage you to look them up. And that is one of many reasons why I feel very privileged to have this conversation and be trusted by my guest to delve into this theme further with her. And for today's episode, I could not have asked for a better guest. I'm delighted to be rejoined by Miss Peppermint, having previously interviewed her on Dating Games and Modern Relationships podcast. And if you're not familiar, she is a trailblazing actress, singer, reality star, and activist who continues to defy limitations and be the warm and uplifting trans representation that she often talks about wanting to see more of in the world. And she's really out there doing that. I was watching a TV show called Harlem the other day, and she popped up in that out of nowhere. And that is one of just, you know, many things I've seen her pop up in and be like, oh, Peppermint, someone I know, how fun. And so it was lovely to have another interview with someone who you may also know from having appeared on Drag Race, originating a role on Broadway, and hosting the latest GLAAD Media Awards. So yeah, really cool activist, someone I look up to a lot, and such a warm and wise person. So like I said, for me, the ideal guest on what is an important but also sensitive theme. So with all that in mind, please enjoy this delightful episode with Miss Peppermint. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hello, my name is Peppermint. And my first real experience with the notion of mental health just as a concept wasn't until much later when I started having some family difficulties around me sort of coming out. And right before I came out as queer, I was probably, 11 years old is when those arguments and conversations and stress and tension started happening. But prior to that, when I look back now, I realize that mental illness and the need for discussing mental health, which we did not, was all throughout my youth and childhood. I have a history of alcoholism in my family, and so it's probably not a surprise that there were several moments where mental health should have been the focus but wasn't the focus, and then mental health was heavily affected or deeply affected as a result of the alcoholism and the incidents that happened throughout my childhood, and they definitely have shaped me today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. One thing that it makes me think about is, unfortunately, some of the stereotypes can be true around Irish culture and drinking, and how with drinking culture being so prevalent and normalized here, certain issues kind of go under the radar. When you think back to your family history with alcoholism, to what extent was that acknowledged, or what ways was it explained away certain kind of patterns of behavior?
Well, alcoholism as a disease or a sort of condition wasn't really wasn't really acknowledged or at least talked about to me, but I was very young. So really just, I knew that one of my family members liked to drink. And the notion was less, oh, this person's an alcoholic. It was more of, this person's drunk again. And we just knew what to do and how to react when that would happen. Or, you know, we knew what sort of what to expect. It was going to be a tough time. It was going to be a tough night tonight. Mm-hmm. And nobody's sleeping, kind of thing. But as an issue of alcoholism, I don't think that was really anything that, you know, because when we view it as a sickness or something that people can deal with, then there are tools and obviously steps that people can take. And there is a way to sort of frame it. And we just didn't have those tools, I don't believe. It was just like, you know, oh God, hide. And so that's what it was, you know. I was very young. And so I don't even think I had the mental capacity to kind of look sort of clinically at the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd say that's very common, that it sounds like it was acknowledged as this is something we all need to be aware of as a family unit. This is something we all need to be wary of, as opposed to there being a clear solution there. And I think a lot of...
Everyone except for that person was not acknowledging. Yeah. And I don't know that anyone was really holding them to account, because they were in a high position of power in the family, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And when, you know, when people are drunk and it's a common thing and you're seeing how much it affects their mood, before long there can be this routine that builds up, right? Where you know how to not set them off, whether it's anger or whether it's arguments, you know, what can we do to get them to hurry up and go to sleep?
Yeah, and they would come from an older generation, certainly not the generation. Well, I think that one of the things that I sort of experience and one of the things that I think that I'm grateful for is that while I do have many friends who are in recovery for substances and alcohol and go to counseling and therapy, I am very much aware of the sort of recovery language and vocabulary that is often used in those settings that I think has sort of made its way into like general society, you know, use of the terms like words like triggers and, you know, safe spaces and things like that. These are things that we all understand whether we've been in a type of treatment or not. And I think that that is good. It can be very helpful for just being able to understand how to connect with and engage with someone who, let's say, has mental health issues or someone who is dealing with alcoholism or any sort of human issue that we are dealing with these days. But that was not the scene when I was, you know, younger and sort of dealing with people from a different generation. This sort of recovery language was not. And I guess in order to use a lot of these terms and ideals, one has to sort of present their vulnerability and admit that there's a certain vulnerability that they have, that we have, that we're vulnerable to these situations and things. And so that was not something that folks were doing in my family and the adults in my family. And I think in the generation that I came from, that was not it. You know, no one was in counseling. No one was going to meetings. No one was like, rehab was like, you just had to be forced maybe to rehab. And rehab is like, that was like something that celebrities did. Maybe, you know, obviously there were 12-step, there was, you know, AA and 12-step programs and meetings, but that was not something that I knew a million people who had a problem drinking. And I don't think I had met a single person who, at least that I knew of, that was actively going to meetings, let alone trying to control their alcoholism. Once they crossed that line, it was like, I drink and you all better watch out. And that was it, you know?
Yeah, I so agree. It's changed a lot. And it is, in particular, it's so exciting to see that progress with language, because whilst I don't have the answer for what the perfect thing is to say in every situation, you know, that takes a lot of factors, like knowing the person, like them, yes, ideally being involved in wanting to get the help themselves. You know, there's a lot that goes into finding the right words, but certainly ruling out a lot of things that aren't helpful to say. I've seen so much progress. And that, just like you say, being part of our day-to-day language is exciting. And when you think back on your own mental health experiences, are there any kind of key milestones that you came across which were difficult for you?
Yes, I can't necessarily explain it, but I do remember I'd been doing drag and presenting in female attire, if you will, for many years here in New York. And so it wasn't a surprise to me, and probably not to a few people around me who knew me, that I'd came out as trans and made a decision then to medically transition. But it was definitely a shock to me that I'd walked out of my door thousands of times wearing glitter sequin gowns and beautiful hair down to the floor and all of these different things, mini skirts, like you name it. But when I was just going to go out of my house self-acknowledging and self-identifying as trans in, you know, not in a gown, not in some evening gown or long ball gown, but just like in a pair of jeans and a little like off-the-shoulder sweater, that was like debilitating to me. And I had the first anxiety attack, couldn't breathe. My heart started palpitating. I was like feeling out of, not in control and very fearful to walk out of the door because I had all these, this sort of self-doubt and fear that people were going to, this overwhelming sense that they're going to know and they're going to see you and they're going to laugh. Like that was like so terrifying to me, which is interesting because I'd gone out to drag shows and I'd have also walked down the street and encountered people who had terrible things to say, cross things to say at me for years. And that never fazed me. I guess sort of in my mind, wearing that drag was, while it was freeing and probably more exposing of who I really am and was than I was even willing to admit then, I still viewed it as a sense, as a sort of armor. Whereas I did not feel like I had any armor on when I was going to go out the door just to go down the street to the store in my like sort of just my natural, quote, feminine self, if you will, for lack of better terms. Mm-hmm. And that was really scary for me. So being able to get past that eventually, I think was a milestone. Because I remember thinking, well, I'm just never going to leave the house, you know?
Yeah. It does make a lot of sense to me what you describe there, because when you're in the drag, you are intentionally becoming a spectacle. It's putting on all these layers and sequins and like this hyper femme performance with people sitting down and watching you perform. And so I guess even when you're walking to a gig, you still get to benefit from some of that armor because you're meant to be looked at. You're meant to cause a reaction. Mm-hmm. And so even when those reactions are horrible, discriminatory ones, they can still seem like a reaction to the exterior, to the performance that you're creating, whereas you figuring out, okay, I'm a woman going to get some milk from the shop and I don't want attention, I want to get in and out. And then if you're getting negative discriminatory attention then, where is the armor? You know, I get that.
And, you know, I don't want to discount, I think it's worth acknowledging that there are so many acts of violence and discrimination, obviously, that come from the outside, from others who you may encounter in person or obviously people online. But for me, one of the things that I needed to be able to understand was that that fear that I had in those moments was radiating from my body and that people could pick up on that. And not to say that, you know, I'm inviting negative attention or calling for it or asking for it. Just to say that, you know, how I feel about myself is evident to others. I mean, I guess that's sort of the other side of confidence. It could be viewed possibly as lack of self-confidence. But I remember, you know, feeling like I had won a battle with that whole sort of issue when I was able to naturally and comfortably come to the place or the thought in my mind of, I don't really care what these people think, you know, and then I'm just going to go get the milk or whatever, as opposed to I was heavily invested. And I guess my thought was that my womanhood is very dependent on how other people perceive me only. It has nothing to do with who I am or what I put out or who I say or what the truth is for me. It's only what they think and will they accept me. And when I was in that state of mind, it was like impossible, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. And I'm so glad that you've brought this up because it's a really difficult, but I think vital part of the conversation. Yes, people can read our confidence on us in the same way they can read our vulnerability. And to a lot of bad people out there, that vulnerability can be something that people target. It is a scary thing, and it's a difficult thing to talk about because you never want it to come across that you're saying you invited it, or that if you'd pretended to be more confident or whatever, because our genuine emotions, our genuine fear in situations like this can radiate off us and be quite easy to perceive. You know, there are ways that other people can pick up on that. And in this situation, the fear is so understandable, right? We see so often trans women being attacked, trans women being harassed. We've all come across statistics. We've read out statistics on this show about just how many ways trans women are vulnerable with their mental health, with their own internal stuff, but also from the external world. And along with that, something that maybe people don't always get is how layered the threat is. Because the kind of threat you describe of the attention you might receive while you were earlier in your transition and figuring out, how do I present myself as a woman? You know, you've had all this practice presenting as a drag queen, but that's not the same as dressing every day. And that's not the same as figuring out, okay, how do I blend in? You know, the threat there is, not only do people give you negative attention, but that negative attention can go along the lines of whether or not your existence is perceived as valid. And I think that's the like intense and insidious threat that you must have experienced that people don't always get if you've not lived this life.
For sure. I mean, or maybe they come to terms with those types of things very early. Obviously, different people, regardless of their gender, experience all types of insecurities. We all do. That's what connects. That's one of the things that connects us. But being a trans person who feels as though our existence and our identities are not necessarily supported, or the development of understanding around those identities is not necessarily supported. If that's not happening, it's one of the things that people will, like, from across the street say, is that a man or a woman? And then there here comes a reaction, you know? But I am grateful for having been able to do that sort of self-reflection. And one thing that later on helped a lot with that, besides just becoming comfortable in my own skin, was, I've mentioned this many times before, but Laverne Cox was doing a talk, and she spoke about an experience that she had in the airport where she was misgendered, and she was obviously in a rush to catch her flight. And she had to choose between, do I stop and have a reaction to this, or do I just go on and do what I need to do? Obviously, she went and took the flight, and she said that she realized in that moment that her womanhood, albeit while she was being criticized and sort of scrutinized by this person who misgendered her, her womanhood was not at stake. And that was, like, profound when I heard that. That was like, oh my gosh, you're right. It really, nothing changes. Nothing changes from the time I walk up to this person to the time I leave. Nothing changes. Their opinion is their opinion.
I love that. I love that way of looking at it. And I want to pick up on something you said earlier about, you know, representation and gender being validated, that, you know, that is lacking for trans people in a way that for cisgender people is not. Mm-hmm. You know, that was absolutely my experience growing up and having certain things which were perceived as male encouraged. You know, I was praised when I was sporty. I was praised when, you know, I fell down and I didn't cry, you know, but I also wasn't praised when there were times when I was upset and I did show emotion. And, you know, other things that are very much part of the human experience that all of us should have access to. And so it is nice to be getting to a place where more of that is being questioned. The boxes are getting broader, and rightly so. But it does still feel like it's an ever more complicated dichotomy. If you're trans, even among people that are trying to be inclusive, there can still be this really binary thinking, to the extent where, you know, like a previous guest, Castle MacArthur, who's a model, who's a transgender man, receives constant hate for modeling and presenting often in feminine clothing, right? Because it's like,
oh, as a trans masculine person who will wear like a dress or something and then get hate for that, you're saying?
Yeah. And, you know, that's the conversation we're not even sort of touching, because the world is so
many
people.
We're not ready for that yet.
So many people are still getting their head around, you know, transitioning as
trans
a concept,
101.
Which is baffling when there's so many things that don't affect you that we can seemingly gloss over and not think about. But yeah. Whether it's media scaremongering, whether it's lack of normal representation, you know, give me a trans person on TV where their storyline isn't about prostitution, or the only interesting thing presented about their story arc is their transness.
Yeah. Yeah. We're working through it. And, you know, we have, I guess the media plays a key part in helping sort of tell those stories and deciding whether or not they want to tell a deeper breadth of stories. But the media is definitely key, because that goes right really into the minds of people who would otherwise never sit down and have a conversation, be able to probably sit down and have a conversation with a trans person if they don't, you know someone who's out as trans.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you some more about drag. So when you think back, understanding your identity more now, how much do you think getting into drag and that interest did come from questioning an attraction towards presenting in a feminine way, and maybe an instinctual knowing that that's who you were?
Oh, all of it. I'd say 100% of it, especially considering that my style of drag, even today, but more for sure when I first started out and prior to my medical transition, my style of drag was sort of like, quote, what you would call just realistic. You know, I just wanted to look like a convincing woman. That's all I was concerned about. I was not really into anything camp or any of that, you know? Luckily, probably because of like whatever innovations there were not with hair and makeup and the things that you would use for drag, since we didn't have a lot of those innovations that we do today. For instance, I don't know, we have breastplates now that are like silicone and they look like boobs. And so you can be very convincing in that way that there's some boobs there when there's not. We didn't have any of that kind of stuff when I started doing drag. It was just like, borrow something from your mom's closet. So if your mom was not very fancy, that's your drag, just everyday lady, and for everyone. And so that was lucky for me that in the late 90s, we were coming out of what they call like the grunge period. I think in that, this is like an unnecessary history lesson, but
no, I
movie stars and celebrities in the golden age of Hollywood, 40s, 50s, and 60s, were very, very, you know, fancy. And they would come to the award ceremonies in like a fur and like their best diamonds. And it was just as like every single event was like high society, very black tie. You were always wearing a tux if you're a guy, and an absolute evening gown. But in the 90s, they were showing up in like a sweater and jeans to the award shows. And so then the supermodels became celebrities, like models who were still willing to dress in an evening gown became our celebrities. And that's where supermodels became so famous, because the movie stars were still famous, but they just were not giving any glamour. And so when we were like looking at our divas, even like Madonna in the 80s, you know, was like wearing ripped up thing, you know, like off the shoulder sweatshirt with a ripped up thing. That was the glamour of it all. When we think of like that 80s style, ripped up clothes and chains, you know, whatever, which I love. So that was the style that I started doing drag in, which was like very, I can't even think of a designer, like Calvin Klein, early Calvin Klein, which is like literally a t-shirt and jeans. That's designer, you know? And so that was my style of drag. I guess my point is that like, and it allowed me to sort of blend in. And so while I was saying, oh, I'm just being a lady, other folks were like, I'm in high drag and you're wearing a t-shirt and jeans. We're all wearing t-shirt and jeans and we're just all looking like a bunch of gals. And so that was great for me. And then when we moved into the 2000s, things started to become more glam. Rhinestones came back in to play. You know, nobody had seen a rhinestone since the 70s. And so then it started to get a little bit more glam and glamour in a way that it had not been before. And so once I started my medical transition, I felt, you know, you could not catch me in like a blue wig or like anything remotely that wasn't like a natural hair color. But then after my medical transition, I became much more at ease. And I'll wear anything now. I'll do anything in drag now, if as long as it looks good, you know. So yeah, I was, a lot of my early drag and my call to drag was really about me being perceived as a woman.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. And do you remember any key points where you realized the dressing and drag, the being female presenting for a night, isn't enough for me anymore?
Yeah. It's very sad, but I remember once I, you know, really got the knack of like getting in drag and figuring out like a comfortable and efficient way to do my makeup that I thought was like, okay, this is presentable and something that I can actually feel good about. Once I sort of got in the hang of that, in the swing of that, and then getting more jobs and work and all that stuff started to happen, I realized that like if you look back on me before doing drag, you would have known this is a queer child. And definitely, I was never like, you know, going out for the football or basketball, sports, any of that. There was no danger of me being like overtly masculine ever. But when I wasn't femme presenting, I felt that way. And I think that people might perceive me that way because of my size and my body. And so as time went on and I started to do drag a little bit more, I was seen out of drag less and less. So there was no pictures of me. I would not pose for a picture unless I was in drag. I would not go anywhere in public. You know, obviously I would go to like the grocery store, but I wouldn't go anywhere like socially unless I was in drag or, you know, femme presenting in some way. For a while, it was just drag. Like there was no middle ground for me. I was either in drag or not. Mm-hmm. I was kind of in hiding all the time. And then I was in a relationship and got broken up with.
Before that, do you mind if I ask, when you were in that headspace, what was your relationship like with your own image out of drag? So when you were at home and when there weren't other people you would dress up around, how were you seeing yourself at that point?
Luckily, you know, doing drag or working in nightlife, you know, really lends itself to sort of being a vampire anyway. And so I would sleep until 4 p.m., roll out of bed, maybe get something to eat. And then before you knew it, it was 8 or 9 p.m. I needed to start getting ready. And so all of my energy was just like, don't look at me. I'm not ready. I'm half dead. I'm just going to eat and then I'll get ready. And so that was kind of my exterior. That's what you would encounter. And then when I was on a day off, if I wasn't getting ready that day, I would just roll in sunglasses and I'd be like, I'm off today. I'm a grunge. Don't look at me. And so that's just what I was giving all the time. And so that was also for myself. I was like, mound of flesh only exists to go pick up more drag supplies
on the way to
and
that.
Get food mm-hmm. on the way to drag. Like, so that's what was my sort of self-perception as well. I was like, oh, you know, I'm just in my in-between phase.
That's so interesting to hear, though, because if you don't mind me saying, there's something that is nearly kind of performative about that approach. That maybe because gender expression had been so informed by drag, that then you having issues with seeing yourself outside of all of the guiche, then there was ways that you could creatively and dramatically avoid that and explain it away and be like, well, I'm off duty right now. I'm going to wear these big shades. Yeah. I'm going to wear a different costume to cover up the man. And then I'm going to be in the costume which actually feels right for me, which is female presenter.
Yeah. And just to be fair, I never self-identified as a man. And I guess I did have M for male on my, you know, documents and things like that. Aside from that, I don't even remember ever. I went from like teenage boy to woman in my mind. Do you know what I mean? And so I was always like offended when people would call me, you know, sir. You know, like I was very, I guess what you would just probably say, wow, that one is a very queer, swishy femme person, even before doing drag, you know, oh, look at her. You know, like you would just have to call me her because there was no question. But you're right. It was very performative. And people would excuse it because my drag persona and my career as a drag entertainer was so sort of prevalent and pervasive, for lack of a better word. Like there was nobody who I knew and socialized with. Everybody knew that I was like Miss Thing in drag and that I was getting ready for a show, you know, so yeah, it was performative.
That's lovely. It's actually lovely to hear because it sounds like it helped to make the early stages of your transition more seamless because there was a way that your femininity was celebrated and there was an art form where you could be flexible with gender pronouns without it being a strange thing, you know, that there's this sort of fluidity that's very accepted in a lot of drag lingo. And one thing you've not mentioned, and maybe it wasn't the case for you, is when I talk to trans people in my life, they often share a kind of stage of fear that you can go through when accepting that you are trans, in terms of the fear of what will this mean for me? Discrimination in terms of finding belonging in the world, in terms of maybe needing to have certain procedures or medication or kind of other interventions, in a way that I guess is parallel to maybe a lot of people coming out as queer, where there can be this fear of how will the world treat me? How will I need to act? How will I find my place? Was there a version of that you found with your gender?
Drag definitely was a buffer, for sure. It really alleviated a lot of that. But I definitely did have to sort of go through the mindset of like, am I going to take these steps or not? But for me, it wasn't a choice of like, oh, do I need to go have surgery tomorrow? Like, I'll just go or not, because there was no money for that. So the question was really, where do you get the money to medically transition? And so that was really the way bigger question for me. And so I, being at a younger age, coming to terms with my extreme queerness, like I want to stress that I was like, I knew I was different. Like there was nothing, there was no closet, there was nothing to hide. There was no, yeah, I was the queerest of the queer. And that stood out for everyone. And so I was used to having been targeted or questioned in different ways my entire journey. And then when I found drag, obviously it provided a sense of comfort and, as we said before, sort of armor, both from attacks, but then also from interrogation for the most part, from other people, especially queer people around me, who would try to differentiate between, are you trans or are you doing drag? I accepted my transness at a very early age. I was probably like 16 when I accepted internally my transness. But I knew what was on the menu in terms of, look at this, are you trans, was Jerry Springer, which is a show in the States where, you know, daytime talk show, where trans folks would often go on, and other daytime talk shows, like publicly come out as trans, you know, to the person that they're dating, who oddly did not know that they were trans, even though they've been together for 4 years and having sex, whatever. There's a lot of, who knows what was going on with that.
Reality
but
TV.
The reaction, the reaction from those people was often violence and anger publicly. And then the audience would cheer the person on to beat up the trans person on television. So when I asked, am I that? No, I'm not trying to get beat up on TV or whatever. Like, and then the other examples of trans women that, I mean, really it was three examples. It was the daytime talk show person getting beaten up and being victimized. It was the white, middle-aged trans woman who was late transitioning after having a family and children and all that, all of those things, coming out as trans at the age of 50 or 60, who probably had access to money so that they could medically transition. I did not see myself as that, you know, obviously, for many reasons. And then the sex worker were sort of resigned to this life of street sex work, you know, where there wasn't an online, there was no OnlyFans. If you were a sex worker, that meant you were a prostitute, and you were, for the most part, and you were probably in New York, especially the girls of color, that meant you were out on the street all night on the corner. And obviously, there was some issues with safety for that. So those are basically the three examples of trans women that I had. There wasn't the example of someone who kind of, in their own time, came to terms, and then the people around them were accepting and loving. So I knew very early that I was trans, and I had this calling that I was this woman, but I just didn't know how to go about it. And the closest thing I had, the most accessible, and at the time, safest thing, was drag. And so I was calling myself for the longest time a non-operative trans woman, meaning I'm trans and I'm a woman, but I've not had surgery and I don't plan on it because I don't have the money and I don't need surgery because I'm 18. And so like that's kind of where my brain was. And then obviously later on, I decided to medically transition, but that was only after the governor of the state of New York had a mandate that insurance companies now needed to cover transition-related healthcare in like about 10 years ago in 2012, exactly 10 years ago.
Wow. I didn't know about that. And in terms of what was covered, I hope you don't mind me asking, are we thinking things like hormones in terms of ongoing, or was there also surgical?
Definitely hormones. There was reassignment surgeries happening. There was top surgery, all the basics. I mean, not really like so much facial feminization surgeries, but definitely like the most expensive of those transition-related healthcare were hormones because it was ongoing, and bottom surgery and top surgery. So those things were what was covered immediately. And not for everyone, but for if you had insurance and, you know, it was tough to do because it was a fight with the insurance, but it was a winnable fight. They were like, what about, oh, did you trip and sprain your ankle once? Well, that disqualifies you. Like, whatever they could, you know, use. Have you ever had a cold? Well, then you can't get it. You know, like, it was like the most ridiculous thing that they would try to disqualify you for. But I fought, and I was quite insistent, and I was able to get my healthcare covered. And so that's when I was able to start, because prior to that, as a drag entertainer in New York, I was only basically earning exactly enough to pay the bills sometimes. And so it wasn't an option for me, you know? And even access to hormones, very early on, I was like taking like soy hormones from the drugstore that were like non-prescription, you know, soy estrogen. I don't even know if that would work or not, but that's what I took, trying to self...
That's what you had.
Self-medicate, but that's all I really had to do until I was able to get my insurance covered.
Mm. And that's so wonderful to learn that coverage is there and is like in law, and yes, there can be fights for it, but it's something that ultimately they have to give you, particularly when you think
New York.
But particularly when you think New York was once a place where if you weren't wearing two items of clothing considered assigned to your gender, that was grounds for arrest prior to the Stonewall riots. And so, you know, it is nice in a time when there is so much happening in our politics all over the world, and there is a lot of pushback on more inclusive healthcare, that there is still progress happening in our lives. One thing I want to ask your perspective on is, I know that this will vary again state to state, but certainly here in Ireland, in the UK, and a lot of places around the world, part of getting recognition of your gender, whether that's getting access to certain medical care, whether that's getting your documents corrected to your affirmed gender, often a step towards that is getting a diagnosis for gender dysphoria. Mm. And so this is something, you know, defined by your gender identity not matching the gender you assigned at birth, and is something that you have to be diagnosed with by a specialist doctor. Mm-hmm. I know there are a lot of conversations around, you know, does that fit? Does this belong as something that is a diagnosable condition in order to get access to certain support? Or is this a part of, do you know what I mean? I don't know the perfect way to ask it. And I think, doing so, you can get an idea of some of my perspective on it, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. You know, knowing that being queer, being gay, being trans was listed as a sickness, as a mental health illness initially in the States, moving from that to just being something that people deal with in their mental health was seen as a win, I think. And the DSM, I think it was officially the DSM-5 in the States, which is like basically the big medical handbook, listed being trans as gender dysphoria clinically, and a clinical diagnosis was key in being able to have insurances, various insurances cover. And then even preceding that was key in having some type of way to say, this is not just a fad. I'm not just thinking about wearing some other clothing. This is a medical situation that needs to be addressed medically. And so it's immovable, and you can't deny me to do whatever I need to do in my life, you know, just because you think it doesn't match up with your religion or your society standards. And so that's kind of what that served as. But it does have moments where it can backfire, because people, although it's a medical diagnosis, it's not seen as a mental illness. People who are not doctors oftentimes still refer to being trans and probably even being queer in general as a mental illness. And that is a disadvantage for us, because then it kind of puts us back to where we were. And so I do think that we're seeing that there are people who are, you know, gender nonconforming, and maybe even trans who opt not to have any type of medical intervention or any surgeries or any of that, or various stages of it, maybe one thing but not the other, but more so the people who opt not to sort of take any medical action. Those people don't necessarily need a diagnosis. And we don't want people to think that being trans is all about surgery, particularly because a lot of people can't afford or don't want it. And so I do think that there is some nuance that needs to be had. I think that the sort of medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria, I think it still can be necessary for at least sorting out. Maybe on one extreme, this person outwardly doesn't align with the gender they were assigned at birth, doesn't necessarily need any type of medication in order to do so. But this person way at the other end of that sort of spectrum has done various degrees of these things and is still in a sense of dis-ease, not has a disease, but not at ease. And their gender dysphoria or how they feel about themselves related to their gender and people in the outside world and their body causes them such anxiety and fear and stress. And also, not to mention that they are a target, so much so that medical intervention, should they choose to do so, would be helpful. And in that case, a diagnosis is probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that. I have nothing to add. I think you summed that up. It's such a good way, and I appreciate it. And so as we start to wrap up then, how do you feel today in terms of your mental health and in terms of your transition? Do you think there's still a relationship there, or do you find that you're feeling more settled?
You know, I'm not currently in therapy, although I do really think therapy is great for everyone, and we should all take care of our mental health in that way if we're able to, should we want to. And also considering that, like, getting a therapist as a part of your medical health sort of portfolio in the States is so difficult. Like, it's like the last thing that they want you to do. And it's so difficult to do. That being said, I try my best in my everyday life to sort of take care of my mental health. It's easier these days, like we said, with the sort of language and tools that are available just in your everyday. And I have that coupled with the fact that for some reason, at an early age, coming out, comparing the juxtaposition to the fear and the tension and the anxiety that I experienced internally when I was not really, quote, out as queer or trans, when I was not out, to the sense of freedom and self-assuredness that I feel now that I am out as trans is night and day. And at that point, given sort of the atmosphere that I grew up in and the environment that I grew up in, I reached a level of happiness and sort of internal euphoria that luckily has not gone away, regardless of whether I had a surgery or had this or that or a job or that. Yes, I have insecurities. Yes, I'm like, oh, my stomach is like not looking so tight today or whatever. Or like, oh, my hair, I need to brush it. Whatever, those little things, those are daily things. But in terms of like the permanent status of who I am, I need to probably dig very deep in order to try to find some type of trauma that is not resolved. And it's probably there. But in terms of what I feel affects my everyday life, my sort of self-reflection and my outlook on who I am, I've been very happy for a long time. And a lot of that probably has to do with me coming out and being able to realize myself, you know, the woman that I am and sort of self-made lady. And so I think I'm in a good place.
I love to hear it. I love that answer. That's a very me answer, because on one hand, you're like, I'm really happy. I'm in such a great place. But I also need to acknowledge the little flickerings of trauma that are probably still rattling around inside here, because if I don't give them a shout out, they might come for me tomorrow.
It's like, yeah, exactly.
You know, it speaks to someone that's, you know, been in many a dark place. And so we're delighted to be where we are today. But we're also like, yeah, I'm not going to entirely take my finger off the pulse. I've got to keep doing the self-care.
Yeah.
That's important. So thank you so much for this conversation. If people want to find out more about your work, if they're ever in New York or want to see you on tour, where should they go?
People should go to my social media, where I keep everybody updated, Peppermint247. And they should definitely stream, if they have not, season 2 of Call Me Mother. You know, speaking of mental health, Call Me Mother, I think, does a good job. While while it is a drag reality TV show, and that's what it is, they do a good job of making space for some of those types of conversations on the TV show. As performers, as queer people, as queer performers, mental health often comes up as a topic or a point of conversation, whether it's, you know, how did you get to where you are as a queer performer and how did you formulate your drag persona? All those things, a lot of times someone's experiences, their traumas are key or at least influential in that as a drag performer. And so those things are addressed sort of from that angle on the TV show every now and again in the personal conversations. And so that's something that was very rare to be sort of very like, you know, sort of mushy, for lack of a better word, on a TV show. So people should watch it, not just for that. It's great entertainment. And yeah, that's what I'm excited about. I'm also excited for a couple new projects coming up in the spring that people will be able to watch.
Ooh, exciting. Cool. All right, well, we'll wrap up there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.